My name is John Wintjens, and I live in Bandenberg, in the suburb Kalki. And today is the 10th of November 2011, and I'm talking here with Hamish Sewell, is it? Well, good morning, Hamish.
Good morning. So, John, let's start at the beginning. When were you born?
I was born in 1930.
And whereabouts?
In Holland.
Yeah. And the war years particularly were a pretty powerful time for you, weren't they?
They were. As a matter of fact, in my youth, it was a difficult time because of the Depression. But the Depression cleared more or less in the later part of 1930s. And the war years were very severe to us. When the war broke out, we were in the front line virtually. We lived on a big river where the enemy crossed. And a lot of damage was done to our village. And during the war, things were very tough. There was, in Holland in general, there was a lot of lack of food, of course. But we lived in the country and we had more food than we could eat. So we were lucky in that way. But there were some severe regulations and things like that going on.
What are your memories of the war?
Well, the last year of the war, 1944, we lived right in the front line for about 4 or 5 months. And it was horrendous. We had a shelter that was dug in the ground, and we lived underground virtually 11 hours a day, 12 hours a day at least. And we were constantly under bombardment from grenades and all sorts of gunfire. And our village was virtually destroyed at the time. There was a fairly large tank battle was fought there. And it was a bad time. And many people got killed, as a matter of fact.
And you would have been in your teens at the stage?
I was 15 when the war finished, yes.
So they're pretty formative years.
Yes, from 10 to 15, something.
And any particular memories which you want to share with us of that time?
No, it's all gone now. There were a lot of people killed, as I said, and during the liberation, what they called the liberation, we were evacuated again to other places, and along the road you could see the corpses. They had not even buried them. And that was quite horrendous.
So you had a pretty close encounter with the mortality of human beings,
yes,
at an early age.
Yes, we did. And life in those last 4 months of the war was horrendous. As I said, we lived underground. We had to scrounge food. We had to go out and try to get food that was still in the fields. It was about September, October. Mines were everywhere. You have to watch it where you were going. And you had no way of cleaning yourself. There was no bath facility, so you were terribly dirty, full of vermins and stuff.
Now, you've ended up in Bundaberg here many years later, and we're here today to record just a part of the story. And it's obviously a very interesting journey that you've come on from Holland in the 19, from post-war Europe through to the Queensland. But the point that we want to focus on today, of course, is this sort of the migration from Holland through to Sydney. And I'm interested to know, just before we start that, how do you feel that time in your life, especially the war years, played themselves out, and why you came to Australia?
Yes, well, after the war in 1944-45, I had to go back to school. The school was badly interrupted, of course. I did my high school, and then I had to go 2 years compulsory military service, which I did in Holland, and in the NATO army. I was part of the NATO forces, and then after the military service, I went to university. And when I finished there, I got married and had no job.
What did you study at university?
Accountancy, or economy, actually. And so I had no job. And in 1958, 59, Holland was mainly restored again to a near normal life. Things were being rebuilt. The Marshall Plan that we had from America that provided the money, it ran out. And the general situation was a bit pessimistic. A lot of people migrated at the time. They went mainly to Canada and quite a few to New Zealand. And some, I believe, to Australia, but I never met anyone that went there, actually. So there was not much prospects. And I had a friend who had migrated to New Zealand, and he was full of praise of it and said, "Why don't you come?" And we decided we'd make inquiries. We went to the Australian Embassy in The Hague and got application forms and pamphlets, like these beautiful sights of Bondi Beach and all these type of things. And we filled them in. And within 3 months, we had permission to migrate.
And you decided to come to Australia instead of New Zealand?
Yes, we did, because I wanted a warm climate.
You were sick of the cold European winters.
I was. Yes. So that's how we got here. Now, we had a choice of coming here. We could come by boat, which would have taken, I don't know how long, but it's considerable time. Or we could fly by plane, and it would cost us £20. So I paid my £20, and we flew out here by KLM. And that was an eventful journey, actually.
Do you want to, just before we get to the journey, what did you think about Australia when you thought about coming? What were your ideas of what to expect?
Well, we had a long talk with the Australian Embassy, and they were all full of praise, and they had the best birds under the sun. And the pamphlets, they looked absolutely beautiful. And the nice warm climate and that, and it attracted us because Holland is fairly wet and damp and cold. So we decided we'd try Australia. And that was the only reason.
It sounded pretty good.
Yes, it did sound very well. Yeah. As it worked out, now after I've been here since 59, it has worked out very, very well.
Mm. So you're happy in the long run, but there was this particular difficult time.
There were difficult times, yes. And I think all migrants go through that.
And you were part of the assisted migration scheme.
Yes, we were. It cost us £10 to fly out here. And for the rest, when we arrived here, we actually were destined for Brisbane. But the weather was so bad, Brisbane Airport was closed, so we went on to Sydney. So that's why I finished up in Sydney in the first place.
What time of year?
This was on the 23rd of July, 59, we arrived in Sydney. And I remember that date very well because the 24th of July is my wife's birthday. And it was not a very happy birthday, I can assure you.
And of course you had a young child with you.
Yes, the baby was 5 months old. So that's how we arrived here, and we had some adventures. Also, from Singapore, we were flying to Biak, that's in north of Papua New Guinea, an island. And halfway, the captain announced that we would go to Manila, because one engine had caught on fire. But no fear, we have three others, and it's all put out. And so we went to Manila, and they repaired the engine. I put a new one in, I don't know. Later on, actually, this is much later on, only actually a few years ago, I saw a constellation, an old constellation here at the air show. And I went to have a look, and I said to the man, I said, "I flew in this thing." And I said, "We had engine problems." He said, "They were noted for engine problems." And he said, "Every major airport had a spare engine." So there you are.
Right.
But anyway, we arrived in Sydney, and it was about 7 o'clock at night. Sydney Airport would have been the worst airport I've ever seen in my life. It was terrible. It had all galvanized huts with a brick facade. and that was Kingsford Smith Airport. We were not expected. We were expected to go to Brisbane. So there were no migrant people there. There were no customs there. They had all closed up for the night. And we had to sit there in barracks with some forms in it. That's all there was. And wait for customs to come. And they did turn up, and there were some 50-odd people on that plane that we came with all women and children, and they all cried and carried on, of course.
You know? So they were other people from Holland?
Yes, they were all Dutch, yeah. And so the customs came, and then they organized a bus for us to go to a shelter for the night. And they put us up in a house in Kensington in Sydney. And that house was absolutely bare. There was nothing in it. They put us in there, and they said, we'll see you tomorrow morning. Now, we did get a small room with a iron bed in it, but no mattress or blankets or anything. I don't know what to do with that, because we had the little baby. And we had to sit on the floor to sleep, and that was it. And the baby, we had a big suitcase, and we made a bed for the baby in there.
Just not wanting to interrupt too much the flow of your conversation, but does it ever make you reflect on what it must be like for migrants today to have gone through that experience? Or
yes.
Especially refugees today?
Yes, I often think of refugees, especially the ones say, I got first-hand knowledge of Villawood in Sydney, the migrant centre there, and I think they have their troubles, there's no doubt about that. But on top of it, they have to battle entry visas and I know what. We had entry visas to come here, we were invited here.
So the doors were relatively open to you?
Yes, they were. The next day that we arrived in Kensington in the morning, there were some migrant people there then, and they had organized a bus and a couple of, two buses as a matter of fact, and a truck to carry the luggage and all this type of thing. And they were telling us we had to go to a migrant center called Shyville. So that was something new to us. We didn't know what Shyville was. But we had nothing to eat. So I said, well, wait a minute. I said, we want something to eat. And then some cafe in Kensington supplied sandwiches and milk. They supplied that.
This would be white bread sandwiches and milk.
That's true.
And how did you find that?
Well, it was all right. There was nothing wrong with the sandwiches. So, and then we went off. They had the old buses at the time, and there were no windows in it, which we found extremely rare, because in Holland you wouldn't have that. The most peculiar thing we saw was the trafficators or indicators. It was the big metal hand that stuck out from the truck. Never seen anything like it.
Are you talking about the wing indicators?
Yes.
Pull out from the side of the vehicles.
That's right, yeah. I thought it was absolutely hilarious. So we went to Shyville, which is about 10 miles, 12 miles out of Windsor, in north of Sydney.
Now, describe Shyville to us.
Shyville was a migration camp, they called it. It would have had, I'm not sure, it had two streets of huts, you call them. They were fibre huts with an iron roof. There was a bed in it, an iron bed, with a not-too-clean mattress and one blanket. And that was all that was supplied to everybody that came in, whether they had 5 kids or 10 kids, didn't matter. That's what you got. You got one room with one bed, and that was it. There was not even a table in it. They were shocking conditions. There was an ablution block, two ablution blocks for the whole camp, which would have contained probably some 300 people. And they were not in a very clean state, I can assure you.
And how many people would be at Shyville?
I think about, thinking backwards, there must have been a couple of hundred there.
And were they all Dutch, or were they?
No, they were Hungarian, I know one lot was. And none of them spoke virtually English. And even the Dutch people he came with were very poor in English. Mm. And we had to eat in the canteen there, which supplied the food, if you could call it food. It was terrible.
So describe the morale there.
Well, my wife cried most of the time. So did the other women that were there. You had no privacy virtually. And it was just not good enough. You know, it was terrible. In the morning you got breakfast. You had a bowl of cereal with milk. And you could eat apples. They had plenty of apples. That's one thing, they did have apples. And for lunch was about similar. You had a couple of sandwiches and a cup of tea or coffee. And for tea at night, you had soup with a cabbage leaf swimming in it. It was just water and that was about all. They had mashed potatoes and peas and a little bit of mince, and that was all.
So very little protein.
Oh, yes, it was terrible. And it was not even nicely cooked, neither.
And were there any controls regulating you being able to come and go?
No, there weren't. You could come and go whenever you liked.
So what was the idea of being in Shiva? Why weren't you just in the city?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. One day, the next day or the day after, they picked us up in the bus and they took us to Windsor. And in Windsor, there was a whole heap of bureaucrats, and they took all your names and stuff down and the whole lot, and none of them could speak anything but English, and most of the migrants couldn't speak English, so I was appointed translator.
Your English was okay?
Yeah, reasonable, yes. I had spoken English in the army and that, so, and I had studied a bit of English, and that was my first job as a volunteer in Australia.
As a translator?
As a translator. And up there, they filled in all the paperwork and stuff like that and gave you, pieces of paper to take so you could show who you were and what you were doing. And all your money had to be handed in to the Commonwealth Bank, who was there. And then they gave you £50 per person, per adult, and £30 for the baby in cash.
Now, can I ask you, did you come with a lot of money?
No, we did have maybe a couple of thousand guilders. And I couldn't say how much that would be in pounds at the time. I forgot. But it wasn't a great deal.
So perhaps a couple of hundred Australian dollars.
Yeah, a bit more than a couple of hundred. And yes, that's, and they gave us £130. They gave us at the time, the pound stays, of course, you know.
And they impounded your money.
Well, they exchanged it, you know.
They exchanged it.
Yes, and it all had to put in the Commonwealth Bank. You had a Commonwealth Bank book, and that was it.
Right.
How you could get it out, I wasn't sure, because the Commonwealth Bank wasn't nowhere near us.
Because you were out at Shiveville, which was a long way away from anywhere.
We were given £12 in unemployment benefits per week, which came once a fortnight. And then we had to pay £6 for board, which was excessive.
And this is to be in the cabins with a single bed.
Yes, that's right, and the poor food, you know.
Right.
So I refused to pay. And the manager there got very mad about it, and he told me he knocked off my block, and I had no idea what he meant.
What was the manager like?
Well, he was an Australian, and I don't know. He sat in his office there most of the time, and the camp was never... He had cleaners in the camp, which were migrants, and what I could gather, they came from Eastern Europe, and... they cleaned the stuff up a little bit, but not very well.
And so, was there any entertainment, recreation?
None whatsoever.
So what did you do in the evenings?
Go to bed.
And how long were you in Shiveville before?
Well, about a week, I suppose. And then I got the fight with the manager. And he told me not to come to the canteen anymore to eat and all this, you know.
Why did you get into a fight with the manager?
I wouldn't pay for the food. I said it was slop, you know, and which it was. And I refused to pay it. Then he said, well, you go do your own. So I went to the phone. There was a public phone there. And I rang the consul in Sydney, the Dutch consul. I complained to him. And he said to me, I will look into it. And lo and behold, the next day a car pulled up with the Dutch consul and an Australian government representative, I suppose. I'm not sure what he was. And they listened to my story. They inspected the kitchen and the canteen, and they said, well, this is not very good. And they made a bit of an issue there with the manager. And the next day, they gave me a warrant to take a taxi, because all the goods we had could be fitted in the taxi, and go to Villawood.
And so, how far away was Villawood?
Villawood, it was... I'm not sure how far it is, but from Windsor to Parramatta, the rail line there was a fair trip. And then Villawood is in Western Sydney there, not too far from Parramatta. And that's where we went. So we were out of the dreadful camp up there.
So this is your wife and your daughter and you?
And myself, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And later on I read that people from that camp were convicted of forgery and theft and I know what, so there was some shenanigans going on.
So there was probably really poor quality conditions in food because there the manager was taking money on the
That's
side.
That's right, yes. Villawood was a lot better. It was nicely painted. We had two rooms there with three beds and... There were tables and chairs, and there were curtains on the windows, and there was a sink, but you couldn't cook there. You had to go to the canteen for meals. It was supplied. The meals were not bad there. We would have liked other meals. We were used to a different type of meal. I think most of the meals were a bit Eastern European type of meals and Southern European, Greeks, Italians.
Were there a lot of Southern Europeans and Greeks
there? Oh, yes, yes. It was a big camp.
And how big is Villawood?
I have no idea how big it was. Because
but it was bigger than Chiville.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. And it was well maintained. There were nice gardens, nice trees and parks and things like that. But I didn't spend much time there because I had to go to work.
So the idea was that you were going to find work, wasn't it?
That's correct.
But at Chiville, it was literally impossible. It
was impossible, yeah.
Why?
Well, the distance to go to Sydney. It was first of all about 10 to 12 miles from Windsor. And there was only one school bus which left at about 8 o'clock or so. And then you had to wait for the train to Parramatta. And by the time we were in Parramatta, it was about lunchtime. So, you know, you couldn't get a job anywhere then in the factories or whatever. So, and you didn't know, this was one of the problems with migration. You don't know where to go. You don't know who to talk to, who to inquire with. You're just a total stranger in the country.
And did anyone give you support and guidance?
Not really, no, not really. When we were in Villawood, I met a Dutch man there, and he was called a hawk because they said he was hawking, but he wasn't. He was selling insurance things and stuff like that. He was after business. But I gave him one thing. He informed us about, say, health insurance and that it was not free here in Holland. It was free. It was not free here, so we had to take measures to have health insurance, which we did. And he informed us, you know, you should get out of this camp and go there and there or whatever, you know. I said, well, how can I? He said, you know, get a job. I'll take you into town, which he did. So that was very nice. And I got a job as a house painter. Never handled a paintbrush in my life. But there was a shortage of people. There's no doubt about it. And I painted a house for about a week or a fortnight or so. And then I found a job as a tram conductor. And so I became a tram conductor.
Where were you working?
I was working in Moore Park, which is in Randwick. in Sydney. That was my depot, and the trams ran from Circular Quay to La Perouse and to Coogee and Maroubra, Bondi, and all these places. And that was not a bad job, actually. I learned a lot of Australian.
And you would have met a lot of people too.
I did, yes. And there were a lot of nice people there, and there were a lot of people that called you bloody wog, you know, and all this type of thing. But never mind. It didn't affect me very much at all, you know. But yes, that was just at the end of the trams, actually. And about after 6 months, most of the trams stopped running.
So describe what it was like to work as a tram conductor.
Well, I lived in Cronulla at the time. And I had free travel in Sydney, so that was one thing. But I had to catch the train, either in Cronulla or I forgot the other place name, and go to Central Station. And from Central Station, I had to take the bus to Randwick, to the depot. And that was at about 6 o'clock in the morning. So I had to be up quite early. Then I worked for 4 hours. And then you were 4 hours or 5 hours off, and then 4 hours on. So it was not a nice day to work. I mean, I sat in Sydney all day, you know, and came home, say, at 7 o'clock at night. Leave at 5 o'clock in the morning and come home at 7 o'clock at night.
And your wife and daughter were in Cronulla?
They were in Cronulla,
so
yes.
You'd moved out of Villawood at the stage?
Yes.
How long were you in Villawood for?
Maybe 2 or 3 weeks.
So the time that you were in the detention centres was really only a month, all up?
Yes, about that. See, Villawood was a different camp then, you know. Nowadays it's all barbed wire and things, but at the time you were free to get in and out, and everyone could enter the place.
And it served to process migrants who were on assisted passage?
Yes, and to give them temporary accommodation. Actually, the rule was that after 6 months you had to leave Villawood, but there were a lot of people there that stayed a lot longer. Mm-hmm.
And you said you worked as a conductor.
Yes.
So you weren't driving the trams?
No. That you go up in ranks then.
So you were dispensing the tickets?
Yes, selling the tickets in the trams, you know, and battling through the crowd.
And you would have seen a lot of Sydney at that stage.
Yes, I know Sydney very well, as a matter of fact.
And what did you think?
Oh, well, it was a big city, you know, and I came from a country town originally, and a big city was fairly new to me.
Was that exciting?
Yes, it was, actually. And having 4 or 5 hours off in the afternoon, I could travel for free through the whole city, which I did, on buses here, and got from one to the other. And I saw the city pretty well.
And what did you think?
I liked it, actually. I liked Sydney, yes. But like everything else, nowadays I wouldn't go back.
Yeah, no. And you said that you were sort of in the hustle and bustle of everything. I mean,
yes, you know, the trams are usually very crowded, and you had to wrestle your way through. You didn't catch all the people, but a lot of people came afterwards, I must admit, and they said, "I was on the tram there and I didn't pay, so here is double the fare." I was amazed at the honesty of a lot of people. And then you had the sideboard trams, where you stood on the sideboard on the outside. And that was actually easy work. It looked very difficult, but it was not. It was easy work. And later on, I sold tickets in the morning in Bondi Junction. It was a machine. And in the afternoon at Market Street and Elizabeth Street in the city. So and you met a lot of people there every day. They bought a ticket off you and said good day and so on, you know, and they talked to you.
What's the difference between the sideboard tram and the not sideboard tram?
The sideboard tram, you walk on the outside of the tram, and the other tram, you walk on the inside.
And were the public allowed to walk along the outside
No,
it was just
no,
the tram conductor?
Yeah, it's just the tram conductor.
So you were able to go from the front of the tram to the back of the tram.
That's
on
what
the outside.
You did, and you sold the tickets there,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and that was pretty much the end of a time, wasn't it? A whole time?
It was, yes, it was.
Yeah. And that tram system was disbanded pretty much around that time.
Yes, halfway through. I worked for a year there, and halfway through they abolished it, well, more or less, yes. There was only one tram left to Watson Bay.
So have you been down to Melbourne and seen the trams there?
Yes, I have, yeah.
And are they anything like what you used to?
Oh, well, they're nice and modern nowadays. Now, in Sydney at the time, they were all rattlers, you know, they were not very nice.
yeah. So from out of this time, you know, coming from Holland and coming over here and going through those detention centres, is there anything that you feel like you can sort of share with us about that experience that other people could learn from?
Well, the biggest problem I had was that none of my education was recognised here. They wouldn't recognize anything, not even the high school certificates. Another problem that I never thought of was the translation of the papers. And I found a translator at Sydney University, a Dutchman called Walters, and he translated all the forms for me for free. So that was very nice of him. And he said that they had problems. He was a lecturer there at the university in Sydney. But he was very nice. And he put me a bit on the right path. He said, look, he said, you're wasting your time standing on a train, which was true. He said, why don't you study and do your qualifications here? And I said, well, I need money in the first place, you know. And he said, true, he said, but why don't you go to the country, find a job in the country? He said, and study there. Get a correspondence course. So I looked in the paper for jobs in the country, and I found one that advertised for a gardener. And I thought, well, I'll try. I was interviewed in Potts Point by a very wealthy man with the looks of him, and he gave me a job as a gardener.
And where did you work?
I worked in a place called Beltrees near Scone. Mm-hmm. And Beltrees is about 30, 40 kilometers out of Scone. And it was a huge property, about 90 square miles. And it went from, it ran actually up to Barrington Ranges there, the property. And they had a lot of sheep, some beautiful horses, and Aberdeen, Angus Aberdeen cattle. He was one of the breeders of the cattle. A very wealthy family, the White family. And there I was employed as a gardener. I did the mowing of the lawns and all that around the house and cleaned the fireplaces out. They had a large place there. There was about 35 rooms or something. The Queen stayed there often because his wife was related to the royal family somehow or another. So, but she wasn't there when I was there.
And did your wife and daughter come with you?
Yes, they did. We had a house there, nice house. And my wife worked in the kitchen. And it was good because she could take the baby with her. And she got paid, I got paid, so we made money. And I studied at night. And we stayed there for about a year. And then I got some of my qualifications back and I got a job in a sawmill in northern New South Wales as an accountant.
Right, so that's how you got into the sawmill industry.
Yes, yes.
And can I ask, out of curiosity, were you studying accountancy or sort of economic stuff? Were you studying out of a desire to rid yourself from the poverty of sort of post-war Europe?
Well, no, I studied economy in Holland, and there's a lot of accounting involved in that, of course. And here I did purely accounting. And that was it. And then I got into the sawmilling business and I stayed in Northern Rivers of New South Wales for about six or seven years. It was in they had three sawmills there from Duncan's Holdings, one in Kyogle, and one in Melangany, and one in Benalbo. And those three sawmills I had to oversee with the books. And it was a big concern because Duncan's Holdings at the time had some 28 sawmills in New South Wales, you know.
And you said that after about 58, I think, when did you come? What year did you
59.
Come? 50, you came 59. But you said after about 2 years, after, I assume, we're talking when you finished the gardening job, things got a lot easier for you.
Yes, they did. After 2 years, we would have liked to go home to Holland, but we couldn't because we had no money.
And this was after you'd finished your study
Well, now I finished my study in Northern Real Estate, and when I was doing the accountancy, I finished the accountancy, and things looked up very well there. It was a good job. They were nice people. We lived in a nice town, and so we liked it. And then I applied for another job in Bundaberg. It was in the paper. Who wanted an accountant, and I wanted to go up to the warmer climate, see? Even the northern rivers can get very cold. And so I applied for a job just out of the hang of it, and I got a job here in Bundaberg in 1969.
And this is, again, accountant for a sawmill?
Yes, for the Bernard Sawmill here. At the time, they had three sawmills. And when I came, they and a hardware store, and they were not in a very good financial position. And they told me that I had to concentrate on costing because money was leaking here and there. And so I set up a good costing system for sawmilling, and it worked well. And the upshot of it was that I suggested we close two sawmills here and concentrate on one, which they did, and we never looked back, actually. From then on, the sawmill made money.
Have you been back to Holland?
Yes, I have been. Been back when my parents were married for 50 years, golden anniversary. I went back with my daughter. My wife couldn't go. She worked, as a matter of fact, as a midwife here. And she couldn't go, so I went with my daughter. That was in 1972, I think.
And what was it like?
Strange. Holland is well known as a nice, neat country, and I was surprised how dirty it was. You know, it didn't look nice anymore. It was fairly crowded. And the biggest problem I had was you see people that you knew, you went to school with and all this, you know, and said hello and all that, and oh yeah, where are you? Well, I'm in Australia. Oh, good, nice. And then they walk away.
Like another universe.
Yes, they don't know you anymore. They have no contact. They're not interested anymore. And I found that a lot, even amongst relatives, you know, that you nieces and nephews and why know what. They say good day, and that's the end of that, you know.
They probably don't say good day.
No, they don't say good day. No. Goeiedag. So then we went back again about 3 or 4 years ago for our 50th wedding anniversary. We were married in Holland, of course, and we went back to celebrate it there with my sister, who is still alive, and we went back to Holland then, and we visited. We were only away for 3 weeks, my wife and I, and we went first to Rotterdam, where she got, let me think, three sisters and six brothers, a big family. So we went to see them all, and then we went to my sister. My brother died, and I only have a sister left. She is in her 80s. And we celebrated the 50th wedding anniversary and had a look around, and Holland is getting very crowded, but it's very neat and nice now.
Is it? And did you go back to your old farm?
Yeah. To my old house where we lived. Mm. Yes, I did go and pay a visit to them.
And how was that?
That didn't change much at all, actually. I was surprised how little it changed. And it was funny, the people that my father was a headmaster of the school. And when he retired, he sold it to the next headmaster. So I met him, and we had a yarn. And when I came outside and went back to the car, and I said to my wife, I said, you know what? I said, I thought, you know, in that lounge room where we were, I thought that was a big room. I said, it's only a very small, pokey room now. And she said, I saw it exactly the same. So the houses seemed to be smaller there, you know, than we got here. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's around 40 minutes. Shall we stop there?
Yeah, all right.
Thank you very much.
All right, you're welcome.